The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Well, that's a big rebound after a horrendous month. Trade deal with China is possible. Not possible. Maybe. No way. Yes. No. And we'll see. Apple dunks under the magic 1T market cap. And our guest today, Danielle DiMartino Booth of Quill Intelligence. All this and much more on episode number 586 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to November. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am your host for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Here we are, starting out November with a bang. Pretty good week over the last few days into the end of October. Kind of some whipsawing action, but it all finished up pretty well. We'll talk about that in a second. I spent some time at the boat show, the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show. And man, prices. Oh my goodness. Prices on boats are absolutely nuts. I had the opportunity to tour a 161-foot just yacht, just this gorgeous machine. Price tag of $32 million, which I heard just a little while ago there's actually a contract on now, so people are buying boats. There were some other boats there that were just amazing. If you haven't had the opportunity to spend any time at some of these boat shows, the boats are getting bigger and bigger and more expensive by the day. So I like these center console fishing boats, you know, those boats that have the console, the steering wheel, if you will, in the center of the boat, and you can walk around all the way and you can fish, and there's all sorts of areas in the deck to store things like ice and fish boxes and a small cabin and maybe a head, or as they say in boating, a toilet, a little area to put things in storage, etc. Well, let me tell you something. I was on a 39-foot center console with triple 350 horsepower engines. Pretty nice. Brand new. What's the price? $650,000. Shocking. I mean, just a few years ago, these things were much more reasonably priced. And what's also interesting is I heard that three people are actually looking to put contracts in on that specific boat now. Now, I didn't hear this, by the way. This isn't like a salesperson. I know a lot of people in the industry, so they're telling me what's going on. But that's not even the most amazing thing from the boat show. Real quick, I just thought you'd just find a kick out of this. The latest thing is bigger and faster and just more intense center consoles, right? These boats that are ocean going at the same time. They are just sleek and amazing. Well, the latest one, the biggest one, is by Hydrosports. They're making now a 65-footer. What I mean by that is, by the way, there's no, like, if you think about these big boats, these big sport fishermen boats, they call them sport fishermen's, or sport fishers, you know, where they have the cabin and they have the, you know, fishing area in the back, and they have the salon, and they have a kitchen and bathroom and a couple of different berths on the left and maybe some storage on the right, and then the master suite in the front. No, no. This is just an open fisherman. This boat is, the total length is 65 feet. Its beam, its width, is 16 feet. There's 45 speakers on this boat. Weighs 46,000 pounds. A lot of that's due to the fact that there are five, not three, not trips, not quads, but five 627 horsepower outboards. A total of 3,135 horsepower. It has 100 gallons of freshwater capacity. Fuel capacity, 1,800 gallons, which you'll need. Cost of fuel up, about $6,300. Top speeds, approaching about 75 miles an hour. And it cruises comfortably at 50 miles an hour. Price tag? What are you thinking? anywhere from, I would say, mid-2s to $3 million for this boat. So a total change of what we've seen in the past, which was bigger and larger salon-style cabin cruisers, sport fishing boats. Now we're getting into these boats that are wicked fast, have outboards, and a lot of people prefer the outboards because if one goes, you don't have to dig out the entire engine out of the boat. Just take it off the back, put a new one on. I mean, each one is probably about $90,000 each or so, possibly more, for these crazy 7 Marine 625 horsepowers. So the boat show was pretty intense, pretty active, very busy. I spent today there. Actually, you know, I had a really interesting experience. I'm on the Marine Advisory Committee down here for the Chamber of Commerce. And we started this committee about a year ago, and our goal was some, there was a lot of goals. I mean, we have some areas of conservation, and we're looking to really bring in businesses and understanding of the local businesses of the marine industry. Also looking for ways to incorporate the boat show, which is a big thing down here. Well, what we did was we set up a breakfast where we got a group of about 100 people, business leaders in the community, got on the water taxi, went over to this great, beautiful boat, had breakfast on the boat. Guy Harvey was the speaker, and he was brilliant. Not just a painter. You know, you probably know him for some of his shirts and belts and paintings. I mean, this guy has an incredible depth of knowledge about the marine industry as well as conservation, the entire aquatic experience, if you will. And just a great speaker. Anyway, just kind of filling you in on what's going on here. Let's bring it on back to what's happening with the markets. And the S&P was up 2.5% for the week. Small caps gained more than 4%. Emerging markets were up 6%. NASDAQ up 2.7%. Asia across the board on average up about 4%. And this is all coming on some pretty horrendous weekly returns going back the last few weeks. And everybody's asking, like, why? Why all of a sudden are we seeing this change of sentiment, this change of direction out of nowhere, right? Everything was being sold off just pretty much recklessly in the prior weeks. Every time we saw a little bit of a spike in the market, it was sold. Sellers were coming in very strong. Volume was up. And what happened? What changed this week? People want to know. What is it? And even if it doesn't really matter why it happened, because we're really just looking at what the end result was, a lot of people, and this may be you, and to me to an extent also, I want to understand what was the dynamic. What are we looking at? Why is this happening? So what I looked at was some of the things like the oversold levels that we talked about on a technical basis that were reaching levels we haven't seen in years. There was talk about the possibility of trade talks with China, the deal that may happen, some discussion about maybe something towards the G20 meeting at the end of November. It was on. We had good talks. It's not on. It's on again. Went flip back and forth about probably no less than 6 times during the week. Buybacks may be starting up again after a blackout period, something we talked about. And all things that we've been talking about with regard to this concern about a slowdown in earnings and possibility of a first quarter concern when it comes to GDP, the pull forward effect, all these things kind of dissipate a little bit. But the one area that clearly seems to be total BS out of all the possible things that could be why markets moved higher was this trade talk. The trade talks are just, it's noise. It stuck out like a sore thumb. Clearly, this whole idea that the story keeps changing, that the administration sends one person out to speak and one person talks on their own. Oh, yeah, things are going well. Somebody says it's not going to happen. Somebody else says it looks like that there's going to be a meeting. Somebody else comes out and says, well, yeah, well, there was a good conversation and that's confirmed by somebody else. It looks to me like it's simply a political move right now that is just looking for some good news into next week's midterm elections. That's as simple as it can be. Of course, there was also, I'll call it, bad news. Combination of good and bad news for the week. I mean, some of the manufacturing numbers slid down a little bit. We saw a really good employment number. That was good. So 250,000 jobs added. 190,000 expected, 3.7% is the current and has been the unemployment rate. So all in all, it's the continuation of the idea that while the Fed may be there to actually keep on raising rates for some time, the employment situation looks good. The economy still looks rather healthy. Consumer confidence was up. Again, there was some slippage in some areas, but not so much that anybody was saying, you know what? Wow, look at that number. There's a problem. We saw the dollar back up a little bit against the Chinese yuan, the renminbi. And that was actually good news also. The VIX came down a bit. But with all the conflicting news on Friday, things got a little bit choppy again. So things were kind of on a nice move higher, and then for a couple of days, and then all of a sudden things got choppy again. We'll see what happens next week in terms of markets. I would expect that there's going to be a lot of movement around the results from the midterms on Tuesday, and that will play into what's going to be for the end of the year. There's some speculation that if the Republicans take and continue to hold the House and the Senate, that's going to be good news. There's some discussion that if the Democrats, which look like there is the possibility of taking the majority in the House, that could cause some gridlock, which generally speaking has been good. But there may be a major uptick in the discussion about impeachment and things of that nature that may really cause some political upheaval and then get nothing done on top of it. So you have all that. I mean, by all measures, it would seem to be that if we can keep things as they are, at least for the time being, from a market perspective, I'm not talking about politics here, I'm not talking about anything else, simply the market, keeping things the way they are right now would probably be the best result. We'll have to see how that plays out. It's going to be very fascinating, actually. We'll talk about that next week a bit. I want to bring on our guest because there's some really interesting research he's recently done in the area of buybacks and the Fed and all that. And then we're going to get to our listener questions. And we have a winner that we picked for this week. You go over to Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Simply just go over to the website. There's a little button to click there and just ask your question. And one winner will be randomly picked each week. We did get a lot of questions in, by the way. We're not going to get through all of them this week. So if you want to send your question in on any topic, we'll read it on the air. I'll answer you personally, or however, we'll get some information to you. And one winner, like I said, will be picked randomly. We have a few questions I thought were pretty interesting this week, so we'll get to that in a second. But right now, let's just get right to the next segment. Let's get to our guest. And with us today is Danielle DiMartino Booth, who is the Director of Intelligence for Quill Intelligence, LLC. It's a new research and analytics firm. She's also the author of the best-selling book, Fed Up, Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. So how are you?
I'm doing great today. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm glad that you could join us. And, you know, I looked back at the recent times that you were on the show. The last time was March of this year, so about 6-7 months ago. I think it was March. Maybe it was July. Anyway, you were on a few times, and we talked about some really interesting things, and I wanted to kind of come back to some of the things that we have talked about and then also bring that forward into what's happening today. Sound good?
Sounds great. It's a much more interesting time. You know, I take that back. March was very interesting, and now we're back to what we've missed between now and March is the boring part. Now we're back to interesting.
Right. Yeah, I would go with that. You know, it's back a year ago, pretty much just almost exactly a year ago, we had you on for the first time. And we had talked about something that was interesting. We talked about how the Fed, and you described the Fed, what was going on within the Fed. It was like a whole bunch of people getting together and they were throwing spaghetti against the wall.
That is true. I don't think they're doing that much anymore, but that is how they used to do it.
So what are they doing now that's different? Because it's kind of, it seems with Powell that he's much more direct and he's much less fluffy and, you know, wanting to, I guess, make it more understandable by the common folk, people not in the biz. But what is there a change in the dynamic of what's happening inside the Fed now?
You know, I wish I knew. I'm really persona non grata at the Fed. But what I can discern from the outside looking in, now that I'm not welcome, it's a funny thing when the subtitle is Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. Yeah. When that's the subtitle of your book, you don't get Christmas cards anymore. You don't get nothing, nothing on the holidays, not a thing. Anyways, but what I see from the outside looking in is that it has become a more practical place to be. I don't think that Jay Powell wants to have his time wasted. And I think that that is an extraordinary change from the genteel way that things used to work at the Fed, where you could devote years of analysis to a body of work that had absolutely nothing to do with making monetary policy. And I think that that has changed in that I think he wants for policy now and for the research done at the Fed to actually be applicable to his day job. And you see that in the things that he has eliminated. There's no more Federal Reserve meetings, FOMC meetings that are not followed by press conferences, because if you're not going to waste Jay Powell's time, why are you going to waste the public's time with a lame duck meeting? He's gotten rid of forward guidance. Why are you going to pre-commit to policy when you don't know what the data is going to be like from month to month? Things change, so should policy. I wouldn't be surprised if what's next up in his queue is getting rid of the dot plot. Because again, why are you telling people what policy is going to be 3 years out when you have no flipping idea? So I think it's a more practical place now.
So what you're saying to me is that there's no more foosball table and dartboard at the Fed.
I think so. I think we've gotten rid of that.
Ah, okay. So let's talk about the Fed and what they're doing. Are they moving too fast? Are they, you know, they talk about normalization, which we've all groused about for the longest time, right? Now all of a sudden we get it and everybody's all grousing about that.
Yeah, you know, it is a very, very difficult time to be the head of the Fed. There are two big challenges. One, he's trying to make up for the sins of his predecessors, going too slow. And two, the data are extremely conflicting. So if you're trying to follow two mandates that are driving you in two different directions, that does not make life very easy. And that is what he's dealing with right now.
So, I mean, there's still obviously, even though the Fed has two mandates, right, which is the whole, you know, full employment and inflation under 2%, we know that they've reached the first one some time ago, although they moved the goalposts from time to time. So we know.
Yes, but the two of us know that they reached it a long time ago.
Yeah, they reached it a long time ago, and then they moved it twice since. And then now it's just like, okay, we're in extra innings with this, and let's see how it goes. The inflation number, you know, we could play with that any way you want, and this, why is it 2%? And I have a lot of other thoughts on that. But in terms of the shadow, what they're trying to do in addition to their two mandates, so kind of like a third quiet mandate, is, of course, to keep markets running along as best as they can. Not only the economy, but, you know, asset prices. They always talk about asset prices, and that's code for stock market, right?
That is code for stock market. But, you know, I would add that there's something new for the Fed to ponder in this tightening campaign, and that is bond prices. So Bank of America Merrill Lynch put out just a little snippet of information about what a world of rising interest rates can do to bond prices. And the losses that have been chalked up since the beginning of the year, if you can imagine, are the third worst since 1970. Investors are not accustomed to losing money in bonds. And that is going to be a challenge for Fed policymakers, because so many mom and pop investors, and Jay Powell cares about them, so many mom and pop investors have bonds as the safe portion of their portfolio and don't understand that bond prices can fall and that you can suffer capital losses in the fixed income safe portion of your portfolio. So I didn't mean to go off on a tangent there.
No, I get it.
Game changer.
Yeah. But the thing is that it all depends on how you own your bonds as well.
Of course.
So for example, let's kind of go through this, because I think it's interesting. One of the ways you can own bonds is directly. You own a bond, you buy a $10,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 piece of a bond directly, whether it's a treasury, a corporate, or a muni, whatever it is. And bond price goes up, so your portfolio looks good. You're getting your nice income that's been, you know, coming in all regularly as can be, whether it's monthly, or quarterly, semi-annually, whatever the particular rate of interest is being paid. And then that will fluctuate. But in the end, you get back your maturity value, assuming there's no defaults and any problems with that beforehand, right? So that's bond one. That's direct. So it may not look good for their portfolio, but that's going to naturally come down to the maturity price anyway over time. The second problem is through mutual funds or pooled investments like ETFs, right? That's the second. That's where there's a big problem. Because
there's a huge problem. Yes.
Right. So you're not necessarily getting the maturity value on it because there's trading that goes on. Who knows what price you actually got in at, and the value of the portfolio could change dramatically. One of the things that is interesting is when you look at what individuals have in their bond component, I mean, the losers right now are the longer term bonds, right? And the
yes, that's where you're seeing the biggest losses. And you know, if you think about Japan, if you think about, you know, what the best investment has been there, which is kind of the poster child of lower for longer, that's been basically a 30-year strip. And that is where you're seeing the biggest losses right now.
And even though we've seen that rates were going to be going up and it's been telegraphed really well, a lot of people didn't shorten up their, I mean, I guess they didn't know to do so. I mean, in our portfolios, we went about a year and a half ago way short on duration and maturities because we said, you know what, there's no way this can be forever at these levels. And if we miss a little bit, no problem. We'll still get a decent amount of income from our shorter term maturities and our short duration bonds. And they've done really well. I haven't seen much of a crack except for some of the emerging market bonds and foreign bonds a little bit here and there, but nothing substantial yet.
No. And I mean, I've done very well, even with some of my medium duration municipal bonds as well. So, you know, as long as you think long and hard about how to position your fixed income portfolio, you're not going to suffer too much in the way of capital losses. But again, I think the third thing that needs to be distinguished here is the type of fixed income that people own. I think that there will be defaults, even in investment grade portfolios. The Merrill Lynch comment I made earlier included, it wasn't just U.S. Treasuries, it was also losses that have been sustained in investment grade bonds. And I think that that is going to be a separate game changer because the credit rating agencies have fallen into their old habit of giving credit ratings that do not necessarily apply to the underlying credit of the issuer.
So I didn't mean to really go this direction, but I want to talk about two things. First of all, let's talk about bank loans. Bank loans are sometimes referred to as floating rate funds. We've used those extensively for the last several years with an incredible amount of positive return, both on basic yield and stability. Just last week, we've watched this for a while. Just last week, we cut that position down substantially, worried about the fact that if there is financial stress that does come up in the markets and the bank loans, which are usually below investment grade, but yet short term and floating because the reset of the shorter term note will come in. And of course, but once you do that and all of a sudden you have higher rates, now all of a sudden that puts additional stress on those short term loans because companies can't actually make their payments potentially. Right?
Yes, that is absolutely right. I think there are way too many retail investors. You have a good understanding of the risks in leveraged loans. I think that there are too many brokers out there who do not.
Right.
And they simply think at it as they've been told by some higher authority that the simplest way to look at a leveraged loan is that it is a hedge for a rising interest rate environment. What they haven't been told is that if a company that cannot access the junk bond market needs to borrow money, then they simply go to the leveraged loan market. In other words, the credit is even worse than that of a junk bond issuer. And that was told to me by somebody who works inside one of the big three credit rating agencies. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful thing at the beginning of the end of a cycle. But once a cycle truly starts turning and recession risk gets factored in, then you're looking at actual defaults.
The other thing that I didn't send this to you, I don't think, and it's actually on our website right now. We did a very in-depth study of the ways in which the average person can own bonds, again, from the aspect of a pooled investment. And there's so much talked about the idea that, well, passive investing, blanket statement, passive investing is a better way to go because you have transparency, you have intraday trading, and you have very low costs, right? That's what we've all heard 100 times, if not 1,000,000 times. And what we wanted to do was do a research piece and look at, okay, if we look at the 8 different categories, the main categories of fixed income, let's take a look at this in on a variety of different levels, from a return, from a risk-reward standpoint, from some statistical analysis, and let's see if actually passive investing holds up to active investing with mutual funds, even though you're paying more fees with the mutual fund for the most part. And we did this study, and I got to tell you, the output of what we did was pretty surprising. It really slanted the whole idea of not using passive investing, even though it's cheap, even though it's intraday traded, even though it's transparent, because the active manager in some of these classifications has so much more advantage than the passive investment. And we're talking about like percentage of returns on a 3-year, 5-year, 10-year rolling period using Sortino ratios and Sharpe ratios. And I mean, all of this just incredible slant towards the mutual fund, the actively managed mutual fund. And especially if you can get into institutional funds, which are more cost effective. So you got. I'm gonna send you a link to that. I think you'd really be surprised. No,
I would be. I would love to write about passive investing, because I think if there's one takeaway from October trading that we did not get in January, it was the depth of the losses suffered in some of these mega cap companies. You know, if you think about Amazon losing $200 billion of market cap in the space of 3 trading days, but think about what that fuel was. It was not just, as I sit here, as we speak, because I can multitask shopping on Amazon. I'm kidding, but to illustrate a point that it is a very powerful thing, and it's ingrained in how we behave. So I'm not saying it's a bad business, and certainly not a stock analyst. But it was a stock that had been driven up because of passive investing.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And if you think about what the mirror image of that is, $200 billion in 3 days, that is what I don't think investors comprehend, in addition to the cost benefit they think they're getting.
Yeah. So let's kind of switch back for a second. Let's stop here for a second before we go any further. Tell me what's going on with this new company that you formed, this Quill Intelligence.
Well, the genesis of Quill is that we're going to basically we're going to change the way that research is conceived, and we're going to change the way that research is delivered. And that is the future of Quill Intelligence. We're going to be using machine learning and looking for actual targets and trying to help a lot of investors in the private space to discern where they should be putting their money. And it's going to have to do with the future of investing, which is going to involve pulling back from passive investing. That is the future of Quill Intelligence.
Wow.
The beginning of Quill Intelligence, though, started with the Daily Feather. And that is a daily product that I put out. It's I call it stupid cheap because it's stupid cheap for all the work I put into it. It's $25 a month. Every single trading day. And it's an outgrowth of the fact that so many people were able to spend $19 buying the book that I wrote, and that was it for them. That was where their financial literacy education from Danielle ended. So this is an outgrowth and an extension of me trying to make the way I look at the world accessible to everyday investors who don't have the money to spend on my institutional research. And it has been just a huge hit. Including with the media. There are times that I turn my mute off in the mornings and I hear people on Bubble Vision talking, and I'm like, oh, they read the Feather today. That's great.
Yep.
So that is basically what Quill Intelligence is.
Yeah, good stuff.
We're going to copyright research revolution because that's what it's going
to
be.
Oh, I like it. Very nice. Well, we'll make sure to put that link on the page for you to go check out, because I was looking at today. Some of the recent things that you wrote was pretty cool. One of the two other things I want to really focus on here is getting back to the Fed for a second. In your opinion, is the Fed moving too fast?
So again, that goes back to the dichotomy with the data. We got the employment cost index out recently. So wages and salaries are rising at the fastest rate since 2008. That's not an anomaly. That is a trend. And the Fed's first mandate is to minimize inflation. So on the one hand, I'm going to start sounding like an economist, they should be raising rates at about once a quarter. And again, Jay Powell has to catch up with the work that Janet Yellen refused to do, because the Fed should have been normalizing rates when she was in office, as opposed to undertaking the slowest, most glacial pace of tightening in the history of the Fed. By the same token, we have seen material slowing in the housing market. We've seen material slowing in the automobile industry. These tend to be leading indicators. We've seen a rolling over in our manufacturing indices after a mammoth run up. These are things that are telling the Fed that 1 year from now, we were probably going to be in recession. So it's a matter of which data they choose to chase, because one of them is telling them that they're going to fail on their mandate when it comes to maximizing employment, because the real economy is already starting to slow. The other one is telling them that they'd better get after inflation because it's rising and it's real. This has to do with the labor force becoming as atrophied as it is, mm-hmm. which was just a beneficiary. That's the wrong word. It's one of the consequences of staying too low for too long, is that the U.S. government was able to undertake the stealthiest expansion of the social safety net since FDR was in office. But that ended up putting a lot of American workers on the sidelines permanently. So now we have this skills mismatch and companies being forced to pay up in order to get employees. So again, there are a lot of consequences of Fed policy, and Jay Powell's fighting them right now because he needs to be raising interest rates. But by the same token, the real economy is slowing. So he's in a very bad place.
Let me tell you my theory on this. And I have a whole thesis, which I'm going to send this to you as well, because I've been pounding the table on this for the last number of months. And this is, there's different names, but we're calling it the pull forward effect, where tariffs were discussed. Tariffs were implemented. There was this kind of rolling implementation of the tariffs over the last several months. We had some more that were being said to be, China will be $50 billion. Oh, we're going to put $200 billion, maybe even more. And what happened was, as I can see it, right when that occurred, we saw a massive lift with manufacturing, factory numbers, inventory gains. We saw all this stuff that went on here. Exports were the last, not this GDP, but the previous quarter's GDP, what was at 4.5, I believe it was. That biggest component of that was consumer spending, consumer related, as well as exports. My thought process is that what's happening here really is a pull forward effect. We saw this in Japan in 2014 when they were going to raise the sales tax for individuals for buying retail goods. And the month before this really went into effect, even though it was telegraphed for a while, the month before it went into effect, sales went through the roof. Everybody was saying, you know what? I'm buying my stuff now. I'm not going to wait till afterwards to pay a higher tax. I'm loading up on toilet paper and paper towels. I'm loading up on food goods that I can store for a period of time. I'm going to buy those things out there that I need possibly in the future, and I'm going to buy a bunch of it. And then what happened right afterwards? Dramatic slowdown, just falling off a cliff. And I think there's something to be said about what's going on now with regard to how the tariffs were implemented, this rolling process with a date that it was going to go into effect, whereas there was just an incredible amount of manufacturing that went on and a buildup of goods by people, manufacturers looking to get in before the tariffs hit. If that is the case, if I am somewhat right about this, we'll see manufacturing start to slow over the next few months. We'll see the GDP start to slow again. My thought was into the first quarter of 2019 was my best guess of this. And then if that is the case, then Powell is walking an even more delicate line, because he has to wonder if some of this is transitory. Some of the gains we've seen, right?
Look, this is something that I have been writing about for months. I wrote about it today. We call it panic buying.
Oh,
and it that's what it is. It's panic buying. And it pulls demand forward in such a way that you see the effect that you saw in Japan before the value-added tax was implemented. The kicker was that last year's natural disasters had already put tremendous pressure on the supply chain, because there were $300 billion in insurance proceeds that were that were just flowing through the system. And we'd already had truckers, the railways that were under tremendous stress going into all this tariff talk. So that made a bad problem that much worse, in addition to the fact that we had the weak dollar. So our export engine was already up and running, and then you give it this super steroid shot, and lo and behold, we see inventory figures unlike any we've seen. We see the supply chain completely buckle under the pressure and wages increase in anything that involves a skilled trade, especially trucking. And now we see, lo and behold, this morning in the ISM report, a big rollover in inventories, a big rollover in new orders, and we're going to finally come off of that high. So we're looking down the barrel of serious slowing into the first quarter of the year, which, by the way, the statisticians in Washington, D.C., have a very hard time accounting for to begin with. We always see this aberrant, very weak Q1 number on GDP. Imagine how weak it could possibly be as the flow through from the slowdown that we're beginning to see because of this pull forward in demand goes into the data in the first and second quarters of next year.
So first of all, I would say that was a resounding agreement.
Definitely.
Okay. We never talked about this before. I've been talking about this for months and months and months, that when I saw what was going on, I said, there's something here that's kind of fishy. But I'll send you a piece that we wrote on that as well.
Please do, yes.
The other thing, though, is what's interesting. This is fascinating to me because we talk about this aberration. The first quarter GDP always seems to be low. And I remember about two, three years ago, there was a fix. Do you remember there was some kind of fix for the GDP of the first quarter? So we wouldn't have this, and we wouldn't see that the second quarter all of a sudden picked up dramatically. They would somehow smooth it or something. And that we're still talking about this aberration in the first quarter. We did it again this year. I don't understand. I thought that fix was in.
Yeah. You know, I cannot explain what, I worked on the inside of one of these institutions, and I can't tell you what they do in order to adjust the data. And they cannot figure out the seasonality to save themselves because the fix clearly didn't work.
Yeah, right. All right, so the last part about this is, again, back to the Fed. And what impact do you think there is an impact that the Fed is feeling from the pressure of President Trump saying, hey, you know, first of all, in his campaign, he was yelling about, you know, and freaking out that the Fed should be, you know, not independent. They're holding rates down too long. Rates have to go higher. This is ridiculous. Now rates go higher, and he's yelling at him again on the other side. And do you think that somehow the pressure that they have received on from President Trump saying, hey, you need to slow this down, it's going to screw things up and all that, do you think that will backfire?
Well, let's just say that Jay Powell decides somewhere between now and the end of December that the economy is actually slowing. What will it look like optically for him to back off of hiking rates in December?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But on the other hand, I'm such a cynic, and I'm the first to admit it. I'm raising my hand. You cannot see me. I'm raising my hand to say that Trump is potentially crazy like a fox because he took such ownership of the stock market rally. He took such ownership of the economy that now he's in a desperate position that he needs to outsource it to somebody, anybody.
There's no question about that he's laying blame that if the stock market fails, it's the Fed's fault. It's not his. I got that. That's very clear.
But now but by the same token, take Trump out of the equation completely. Had Trump been quiet as a mouse or not, I don't think Jay Powell gives a damn. I don't. This is somebody who people need to study his resume to understand what makes this man tick. He's worth $100 million. So he does not need the Fed's pension. He once worked for a dollar salary to educate the Congress on the perils of the U.S. defaulting on its debt. He is at the Fed because he wants to be there. He wants to serve his country. He's doing what he thinks is right, and he could give a damn what the president has to say.
How do you make his money?
Private equity.
Oh.
He founded the Industrials Group at the Carlyle. And that's something else people need to know about Jay Powell, is that he's been listening to CEOs saying that their wage costs have been increasing long before it took its time to show up in the actual data, which we know happens with this tremendous log. lag, excuse me. He speaks to CEOs. He's a man on the ground. He understands hedge funds. He understands private equity. He understands the concept of dry powder. He knows exactly what's going on in the credit markets and the stock market because that's his background.
Interesting. I mean, it's much, in a way, you have to appreciate the fact that you have someone who understands business and it's not just an academic, obviously leading
the
Fed.
Can we get a hallelujah? Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about that. Great stuff. Great stuff. Danielle DiMartino Booth from Quill Intelligence, the director of this new and what were you going to copyright again? What was the?
Quill Intelligence.
No, but you're copywriting something, research something.
Hashtag research revolution.
Research revolution. Yeah, that's
it's gonna be, it's big because you know what? There's one thing that I learned about being inside the Fed, and that's never have an agenda. And I think too much research in this country is delivered to investors with an agenda. So I'm going the opposite direction.
No agenda. Very good. Hey, I appreciate you coming aboard. We'll talk very soon.
Let's do it again soon. Thank you very much. Take care.
It doesn't get more meaty than that. That was great. I really enjoy speaking with her. Her information is straight. It's to the point. There's just no beating around the bush. I mean, she really gets to the heart of what we need to know, how we need to address it. This great stuff. I really enjoy every time Danielle comes on the show. It's always some really just great pieces of information, nuggets that you could really use. So I'm so pleased that we had the opportunity to bring on some guests like this. Just great stuff. And that's what we're here for, right? I mean, it's all about the whole idea of learning and getting some really good information that's not sloped, slanted, twisted, one-sided, cell-sided. It's all about, you know, helping each other. And that's, I try to bring that to you. My guests bring it to me each and every week. It's just another way to really enrich our abilities as investors, understanding our finances, making sure that we're successful long-term. And that's the bottom line. And with that, we have these questions. I asked people to send in questions, any questions they had. And I thought through the end of the year, what we do is give away a book. So we're going to send out a copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. By the way, you can get it over on audiobook too, over on Amazon/Audible. But we have some extra books here that we've been sitting on for a while, and we're going to actually send some of those out. I think there's some great information in there on the areas of technical analysis and quantitative analysis and understanding, you know, everything about looking under the hood, some definitions, ratios, a whole host of really interesting things. But you can send those questions in, like I mentioned, over at the Ask Andrew section. Just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on Ask Andrew, send them in. And if we pick your name out of the random list, well, you're going to win a book. The first question, though, that this week comes in is from Jack Klein. He says, hey, a question for you. What is your feeling concerning closed-end funds? Many trade significantly below their net asset value, NAV, and offer some interesting yields in the fixed income space. You know, that's interesting because there are some very good opportunities available if you're smart, understand how to really look at the underlying portfolio, and more importantly, I think, really recognize and research why is it below fair market value. In other words, it's below the market value of the underlying securities. That's what it trades at. And as such, is it really a bargain or is the fund maybe just trading at a level of, we'll call it illiquidity, so that's a factor why it's trading there? Or what's going on, why it's causing it to be below NAV? Is it possible that somehow they're marking the price up, but yet the price of the underlying securities are really less? I mean, there's just so many different ways to look at this. But I do agree, Jack, that there are some that could offer some really interesting opportunities, especially those that maybe have a really rich yield. And then you have to ask yourself again, why is it so rich, the yield? I mean, why is something offering me 12% yield that's trading below NAV? I mean, what's happening there? Why is it being bid up at a premium rather than a discount? So I think they're, again, doing your research and finding those that make sense could be very beneficial for you. Next question comes from Steve Kamm. He says, this is kind of interesting. He says, how do you reconcile consumer sentiment versus the savings rate? If consumers take money and put it into savings and pay down or pay down debt, which is a good thing, then they naturally have less money to spend or consume. We can't have both. So how are these two contrary events measured, and is one actually better than the other? So, and he mentions he was listening for about 3 years now, and he really enjoys it. And I thank you for that. That's really means a lot to me. But let me break this down for you, and let's see if we can get into this and make sure I answer this correctly. So the question really is about the idea of consumer sentiment and savings. So he's saying, you know, is it possible that consumers are really excited, which would turn out to be obviously maybe a higher retail sales rate or some kind of a spending rate compared to the savings rate? And if the savings rate is high and consumers have a lot of high level of sentiment, how do you get both, and how can that be the case that works together? Doesn't it seem to be, you know, if people are saving, they're not spending? I mean, the fact is people can be doing both. The savings rate could be going up, yet at the same time, it's possible that they're doing so and they're feeling so good about things that they're putting money into savings and they're saving money, but yet at the same time, expanding credit. That's leveraging. They're feeling, you know what, hey, I'm feeling pretty good. My income is better. What I'm going to do is, hey, I'm going to borrow some money and I'm going to expand. I'm going to spend. I'm going to buy some things. Maybe I'll put on credit cards. I'll put my money in savings at the same time. Pay down maybe debt. There's a lot of different ways to look at this, right? Paying down debt, increasing debt, paying down savings, spending money. There's a lot of different areas that you could relate to this whole idea of consumer sentiment or spending and savings. But in theory, if you are very confident and you are earning more money, it is possible that you're doing both. You can be highly confident paying off your debt, bringing down debt, paying cash for things, and saving more at the same time. Isn't that possible? That would really almost be the best of all worlds. And in fact, if consumers are paying down their debt, it gives them the opportunity to once again leverage sometime in the future versus being tapped out. And also, is it possible that by paying debt is bringing up their confidence? You see how this is a never-ending discussion about how this all works? So I don't think you just look at those two things or even some of the components that go beyond those two areas to make a determination. So you have consumers that are highly confident currently and in the future. You may have a savings rate that is going up, credit that's being paid down, but at the same time, maybe they're buying something else in a different way. Maybe they're spending cash because they have more money. So I think there's more to look at. Like, for example, maybe you want to look at retail sales. You also want to look at manufacturing. You want to look at who's spending money, where they're spending. Is it possible that prices are coming down so they're not spending more, but they're buying more goods? I mean, there's just so many different variations of how we look at this. It's not, unfortunately, Steve, and I think the answer to your question is this. How do you reconcile this? The answer is you can't. There's too many variables. You have to look at the bigger picture, step back, and look at how all this is working together for the economy and how companies are therefore profiting from it. And if earnings are going up for the company, whether it's because they have higher revenue or maybe, like we've seen recently, their earnings are going up and growing dramatically due to the fact that they got a really good bump to their margins due to a significant cut in taxes, that's good. It may be artificial for a little while and may cause us to have a much tougher environment to match in the future, but still, again, so I don't think these two things or even the areas that you're looking at are the only things that you need to look at in order to reconcile and feel good about things, because there's too many variables. Sorry for not answering your question, but that's the point I'm trying to make there. Next question, Simon Davies, he says, hey, back in the day when oil was below $35, there were some stories of people hiring oil tankers and ships and filling them with oil and then leaving them anchored somewhere as a speculation play on oil prices going up. I was wondering, if this actually were true? And if so, is it known if these people made any money? So Simon, yes, it was true. We saw some satellite imagery for a long time. We knew and heard from the sources that were doing it that they were actually stockpiling oil in these ships. We saw that in the shipping companies as well, the container ship companies. We saw these in on the books and records of the companies that were actually doing this. Plus, there was others that we didn't know about, but we heard about. And again, we saw visual confirmation of this through satellite imagery. So if they were in fact buying at 35, the question is, well, how long did they hold it? What was the cost to hold it in the ships? Because it's not free just to have these tankers. They had to either buy them, rent them, lease them, something. So yeah, if you think about it, if they held them long enough, there was some money to be made, net of the expense of holding it. So I'm sure there was plenty of money made by some people, maybe some break-evens from others, and maybe people that couldn't hold it any longer that just said, I can't do this any longer. It's costing me too much money to hold on to it. Probably lost some money, but that was true. Next question, David Sebastian. He says, hey, Andrew, I love the show. I've been listening consistently for 8 years now. Hey, there you go. Thanks, Dave. Your insights and unbiased opinions are greatly valued. Appreciate that. He said, I'm working in a family office out of Silicon Valley and everyone is talking about the unicorn class. Everyone is poised for the start of 2019 to IPO. What are your thoughts on the VC market affecting the broader indices? So here's my take on this. So I think venture capital has a great amount of potential of creating and nurturing and expanding the idea of capitalism, right? Just the very nature of it, that there's outside money being brought in a very speculative position to new companies. And the hope is these days that, you know what, we're going to take that one day and we're going to IPO it and make all sorts of money from this. Now, at the same time, there's a lot of money that's lost. Not every situation that comes up through the VC process is a profitable one. A lot of money lost. But at the same time, we're also finding that a lot of these IPOs that are being brought through and really trying to be pressed through are just piles of junk. Just a financial process that is a lot of hype and they're brought to market in the attempt to pay back the VC companies and their investors and therefore pushed on the public markets as a way of recouping their assets. By the way, he asked one further question, I think, about the indices. You know, how does this affect the broader market indices? So I think when there's good ideas, it's brought into the market. You know, you look at a company like, Snap. You look at angel investors and first and seconds in VC. You look at private equity. You look at all these different kinds of capital raising, these capital raising processes and all these various ventures and all the investors that put money in the high hopes that one day they're going to be able to not only find something that's really a wonderful company, but then take it through the entire public process where they can finally have it, you know, trading as a stock and make some money from not only going public, but also the next level and next leg if it's a consistently good money earner. I don't know if it really affects the broader indices. It takes some money out if, in fact, there's too many IPOs that come out to play, just the more shares that are out there. There's more places to put your money. So I think it's a good thing, VC. I don't know it really necessarily has too much of an impact, except for the fact it does detract from some other investments. There may be money being pulled out of a lot of areas and then pushed into the IPOs. However, one thing I'll mention, that even though there is a significant desire to IPO, to push your company onto the public markets and then gain from that opportunity, depending on market conditions, is going to really tell us how many of these actually do come to market and how many say, you know what, we're going to wait for a better time to actually come out and play. And we've seen that many times recently where companies have said, you know what, we're going to shelve this for a little while at least until market conditions are a little bit better and more manageable for us to IPO. So I think that there is a mixed answer on that as well, and that it can have a negative effect because of the money being drawn out. But again, it has a positive effect as well because it does bring us the next level and next players that may be, you know, coming out as a great opportunity for individual investors to hop on once the IPO is placed. And of course, there's not many places that you can pool the amount of money that they need to be successful. So VC and PE and the likes are wonderful, wonderful parts of capitalism. All right. So the winner of this week, we randomly pulled it, is Stephen Kamm. Steve, do me a favor. Send over your address and we'll send it over to the info at the email address, info@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And we will rush out a autographed copy of The Disciplined Investor book for you. And I appreciate your playing along. So we'll keep that up through the end of the year. All right, with that, we're going to end this week. Lots of discussion and great commentary from Danielle DiMartino Booth. Make sure to check out the things that she's offering, the freebie daily and all that, and some of her other offerings that she puts out. And what else? Oh, of course, put your questions in for Ask Andrew. Check out DH Unplugged each and every week on Tuesdays. Myself and John C. Dvorak are talking about all the things that you want to hear about. We're going to kind of break down the Apple's earnings and the thing that they talked about that freaked everybody out. We're going to bring that up and why the stock was down 7% on Friday. And we'll talk about all the things related to the elections, et cetera, and see how that goes. So tune in to dhunplugged.com live and streaming chat room 9 p.m. or check it out on your favorite podcast directory. With that, I'm going to wish you a wonderful evening, a wonderful week. We'll pick it up again soon. Thanks for joining me.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.